Hello, and thank you very much for coming today. I'm Emma, and this is Jo. And we just want to say a few words about our research project. Intimacy Unguarded is a Central St. Martin's research project which investigates the use of personal and intimate as material for contemporary art and writing. Jo and I developed the project following discussions about our different practices as an artist and writer, and we were excited to see how issues we shared a common interest in might be interrogated and discussed for a wider audience. This is our third event. Our first symposium looked at autobiography, biography, and memoir. Our second event hosted US writer Chris Krause for a seminar where we invited participants from Central St. Martin's, After All, and Raven Row to write a letter to Chris Krause. And in the evening, we hosted a reading with Chris Krause from her book, I Love Dick, with a Q&A. We're delighted to have you here today and wish to thank you for joining us. We'd like to outline that this day, although carefully constructed and considered, is not too formal. And we welcome the sharing of your thoughts. So when we have Q&A sessions, we really want to encourage you to participate. The title of this symposium, Gender, the Unconscious and Contemporary Art, was devised to open out questions rather than to focus too much on fixed positions. Gender is increasingly fluid, yet it crops up again and again in the territory we try to unpack through our project. We've brought together a panel from different fields, artists, writers and psychoanalysts, to address issues from differing viewpoints and perspectives in order to hopefully make a really interesting and thought-provoking day. We'd also like to thank our wonderful speakers for agreeing to participate. You have their details on the sheet, which is part of the information you've been given. So we're not going to introduce each speaker as we go along. We'd like you just to refer to that. We'd also like to thank the Freud Museum for hosting this event, especially to Carol, Lily Spain, and Ivan Ward, as well as the other staff who made this day possible, and Francisco da Silva and Daniel Bento. Thanks also to Central St. Martin's Research, the Central St. Martin's Art Programme, especially Alex Shady, and Raw Funding for supporting this symposium. And can I just remind you to turn all your phones and tablets onto silent, please?
Thanks.
Okay. Joe's going to start.
Okay. Hi. I've changed my talk slightly. As I was finishing the preparations of it yesterday, I realized that it was just too long. And to do justice to both Louise Bourgeois and Alice Anderson's exhibition would take me over the 30 minutes that we've allocated to each of the speakers. So I've decided in the end to just talk about the Louise Bourgeois show. I do have the slides that I would have shown for the Alice Anderson show as well at the end of the PowerPoint. So if you want to ask me about it at Q&A, I'm happy to talk to you about it. Or if you just want to take me aside today at any point, I'm happy to do that as well. So I apologize for that, but I felt to do justice to both of them was just not going to happen in 30 minutes. So my talk today is called Autobiographical Fiction, Intimate Encounters with Melanie Klein. So Anna Freud displaced again inside the Freud Museum. Let me tell you a little bit about the context of this talk, which I think will help. I'm in the process of finishing a book on the Freud Museums and their relationship to contemporary art, and it's called Inside the Freud Museums, History, Memory, and Site-Responsive Art. And I'm looking at both the Freud Museum in London and the one in Vienna and trying to think about what it means for contemporary art to be associated with a personality museum in the larger context, so a museum dedicated to the life and work of an individual, but particularly what happens when contemporary art enters these two museums. You may know that The Freud Museum in London has had about 85 exhibitions since it opened, contemporary art exhibitions, so it's had loads of shows. The Freud Museum in Vienna is a totally different beast, totally different museum, totally different concept for a museum. And its relationship to contemporary art is very, very defined, very specific, and they have a small conceptual art collection that they show sometimes in its entirety, and sometimes they show individual works. This is just a list of some of the artists that have shown at the Freud Museum. So international artists, emerging artists, national artists, just a whole range, which is the beauty of this project, the book project, in that there's a diversity of things to consider. The way in which I ended up thinking about the book was to spend a lot of time in both museums with both of the exhibitions that were held at the Freud Museum in London, so looking at the archive here and then going to Vienna and talking to the then director and looking at the work there. And what emerged was that I really wanted to write a book that had both a scope of contemporary art examples within the context of psychoanalysis, within the context of personality museums. So I was working kind of at three levels, making decisions about what was going to be included in the book and how I was going to frame the book. So I ended up using a set of themes. Oh, that's really very bad. Okay. So a set of themes emerged, and I'll just quickly tell you what they are. The first chapter is on the consulting room. A group of artists worked on the consulting room, showed work in the Freud Museum, London mainly, related to the consulting room. And of course, when you're thinking about psychoanalysis, the first thing you consider is the consulting room. So that's it. I'm very keen also in this book to talk about process and practice, so to see psychoanalysis as a practice. The second chapter is on archaeology, and it's called The Archaeological Impulse, and it's looking at Freud's antiquities, the use of archaeology as a metaphor for Freud within his writing, to understand the formation of the subject, but also to understand the practice of psychoanalysis. And there are quite a few exhibitions that deal with this in various ways. The third chapter is on dreams. I'm just not that interested in dreams. So that was very hard to write. The exhibitions are great, but God, I just don't care about dreams. But it had to be in there. I could not have it in there because it's so central and key to Freud's understanding of the technical aspects of the process of psychoanalysis. So, the fourth chapter is on trauma. A great many exhibitions, really excellent shows, dealt with trauma, particularly in relation to, as you may know, Freud's exile from Nazi Vienna to London in 38, and then his death in 39, and then all of the information that Anna Freud received from the Red Cross about the extermination of Freud's extended family during the Holocaust. That chapter is related to the Holocaust, but also South African apartheid, because there were exhibitions that were dealing with that as well. And the fifth chapter is autobiographical fictions, looking at artists who use personal material in their practice, and what happens to that once it goes into the Freud Museum. And the, I guess the conceit I have in that chapter is that this kind of work creates a set of fictions and a set of narratives of the artist being in analysis. So that chapter is looking at four exhibitions now, all of which represent some part of the psychoanalytic process. And the talk today is from that chapter. So it originally included Alice Anderson and Melanie and Louise Bourgeois. Okay. And then the final chapter is dedicated to the Freud Museum in Vienna and its presentation of itself as a non-museum, as a conceptual museum. Having said that, much of the Freud Museum in Vienna and Bergasse 19 is central and key to this book project. So it's there both in its contemporaneity but also in its history, because, of course, Freud spent 47 years of his life there, seeing patients and also writing the bulk of the works on psychoanalysis. Okay, so you get a sense of the overall project and the paper that I'm going to give today. There's something else I want to say about this talk. Originally, when I was deciding what to speak about, Emma and I had a chat about it, and she said, oh, well, you know, present something in from your autobiography chapter. And I said, okay. And then I really thought that I wanted to present work that was not about Sigmund Freud. So exhibitions that did not really use him as the standard of psychoanalysis or as the bearer of psychoanalysis. I really wanted to look at exhibitions that used other analysts, and particularly female analysts. So that was a decision. There are very, very few of the 85 exhibitions. Very few have really a significant relationship to Anna Freud or Melanie Klein or post-Freudian analysis. Okay, so I had a small group. And then I wanted Anna Freud to be there because very few exhibitions really relate, in a sense, to Anna Freud, which is quite interesting but also quite shocking, given that the museum is a Sigmund Freud and Anna Freud museum. So that's part of my thinking. And then in making the decision to cut out the Anderson, I've ended up with the Louise Bourgeois show and the fact that it's the most unusual of all of the shows, but there you go. So it's not representative, really, of many of the shows, but here we go. It's what I've chosen. Okay. Being with Freud. Sometime in November 1937, a rather extraordinary photograph was taken of writer and practicing psychoanalyst Princess Marie Bonaparte filming her friend and analyst Sigmund Freud. From entries in Freud's diary, we know that during this winter, Marie Bonaparte visited Freud for her ongoing psychoanalysis. The photograph shows Freud sitting behind his desk, turning away from us and facing his patient and friend. Bonaparte is crouching down, looking through an early movie camera that she had recently purchased. We don't know if she's filming Freud or is just posing for the photograph. Is Freud being filmed or posing by turning to look at Bonaparte? A piece of autobiographical documentation, the photograph also has elements of being constructed, and thus of fiction. What fascinates me about this image is that I'm granted the right to see the apparatus for looking, the movie camera, the operator of the camera, Bonaparte, and the object of her gaze, Freud. This mise-en-scène makes it a compelling representation of representing a photograph of a filmic encounter, specifically an encounter between Bonaparte and Freud. In addition to this rather remarkable portrait of looking and representing, there is an intensity figured between the filmmaker and the sitter, as each holds the gaze of the other. For me, this photograph is less a portrait of Freud, or of Bonaparte filming Freud, although this is rather marvelous, and more a documentation of Marie Bonaparte's engagement with Freud. It strikes me as an image that tells us a great deal about Bonaparte's response to being with Freud, perhaps even a response to a cherished, intimate encounter with Freud. The focal point of the photograph, unlike most portraits of Freud, is not the elder psychoanalyst, but his Anna Lizanne Bonaparte. More specifically, the focus of the image is the relationship between the Anna Lizanne and the analyst. Because it concentrates on figuring the relationship between them, as a piece of documentation and a complex piece of autobiographical construction, I consider it an autobiographical fiction. It is part documentation and part fiction. It conveys Bonaparte's desire to be a part of the world of her analyst. The image stages and represents subjectivity, and in so doing fictionalizes it. In this instance, the autobiographical fiction could also be read as a moment of analytic transference, a positive transference, wherein the patient's unconscious desire for her analyst has risen to the surface and is captured in this representation. Bonaparte has been photographed inside the psychoanalytic stage. One of the Freud Museum London's most pressing provocations is to do what is to do what has been captured in this photograph, to encourage its artists and visitors to enter the psychoanalytic stage, to walk into the museum and somehow at the same time walk into Sigmund and Anna Freud's consulting room. This is certainly a part of the museum's hagiographic power, its ability to make us believe we are in an active living consulting room in which the psychoanalyst has momentarily stepped out of it. As we wander through the rooms, we wait for the analyst to return. A group of exhibitions carry this fiction forward for us because the artworks rely on fragments and traces of the artist's own life, anecdotes, stories, memories, and objects that once inside the Freud Museum respond to the psychoanalytic context of the site to create a fictional narrative of the artist in analysis. In this talk, I would consider one intervention, the exhibition of Louise Bourgeois's work entitled Return of the Repressed from 2012. This exhibition included a set of artworks and importantly, and most importantly in a sense, a selection of Bourgeois's extensive writings around her experience of being in psychotherapy. I've chosen this intervention because unlike most exhibitions that invoke the figure and work of Sigmund Freud, this show introduces us to the history of psychoanalysis after Freud by working with Melanie Klein, acting out The Return of the Repressed. In 2004 and 2010, Bourgeois' assistant, Jerry Gorovoy, discovered over 1,000 loose-leaf sheets of writing in the artist's Chelsea home in New York City. These notes, which included both text and images, related to the more than 30 years of psychoanalytic treatment that Bourgeois undertook between 1951 and 1985. This is a dramatic discovery given Bourgeois' longstanding criticism of psychoanalysis. It's one of those, oh, but you've been in analysis for 30, why are you saying these things about psychoanalysis? And it's really kind of, she displaces it all the time in her practice, and she didn't want her practice to be talked about it, even though certain art historians have done that. So to begin to make sense of this archive and its position within Bourgeois' oeuvre, art historian and curator Philip Lauret-Smith brought together many of these papers, along with an extensive array of Bourgeois' artwork, for the landmark exhibition, The Return of the Repressed. Now, the exhibition was first shown in a very large museum in Argentina and then traveled to Brazil, and a small portion of the works were shown in the Freud Museum, London, in 2012. Having said that, the intervention that took place within the Freud Museum included 79 items, which is just extraordinary amount of items. And it's an extraordinary amount of items, and it's also an extraordinary amount of items to be placed in the rather small Freud Museum, 20 Marsfield Gardens, and also the Freud Museum itself has lots of stuff in it already. The site-responsive affect of this crowded intervention constituted something rather extraordinary and rather interesting. On the one hand, we were given access to documents and artworks that would transform our collective understanding of Bourgeois' art practice and its psychoanalytic dimensions. On the other hand, the curation of the show, particularly the choice and density of the material, produced an intense love-hate experience of being with the work, of being in the show. Confined and held by the Freud Museum's powerful psychoanalytic and domestic setting, the engagement with Bourgeois' intimate and powerful accounts of her feminine subjectivity took on a complex psychoanalytic experience of acting out. In order to unpack this, it is helpful to focus on Bourgeois' psychoanalytic writings that dominated the exhibition's affect. By having these personal writings framed and displayed, they turn into a form of art. And the writings speak to the many sides of someone we know as Louise Bourgeois, this figure. Okay, so I've tried to kind of present this part of the talk as mimicking the best I could the experience of being in the show. In one of these documents, we read Bourgeois' witty, fulsome, and powerful assessment of her psychoanalysis. The analysis is a gyp, is a trap, is a job, is a privilege, is a luxury, is a duty towards myself, my husband, my parents, my children, my, is a shame, is a farce, is a love affair, is a rendezvous, is a cat and mouse game, is a boat to drive, is an interment, is a joke, makes me powerless, makes me into a cop, is a bad dream, is my interest, is my field of study, is more than I can manage, makes me furious, is a bore, is a nuisance, is a pain in the neck. All valid points, I think. Okay. In another piece of her psychoanalytic writings, we encounter Bourgeois' wants. I want to get, I want to keep, I want to say, I want to tell, I want to see, I want to learn, I want to know, I want to know, I want to control, I want to hold, I want to feel, I want to remember. I want to go, I want, I want to find, I want to finish, I want to get rid of, I want to clean, I want to be good, I want to be better, I want to do it, I want to show, I want to outdo, I want to top it, I want to accomplish mastery. And the insistent and constant wanting continues for another 4 pages. That was one page of it. All 5 pages, handwritten, are framed and hung side by side. Okay. Close by, we also encountered her sense of failure. Step number 4. I have failed as a wife, as a woman, as a mother, as a hostess, as an artist, as a businesswoman, and as any 47, as a friend, as a daughter, as a sister. I have not failed as a truth seeker, lowest ebb. And then we read Bourgeois' note. When I do not attack, I do not feel myself alive. This form of writing continued unabated throughout the exhibition. We know that Bourgeois was extremely well-read in psychoanalysis. She has references in her writings to Sigmund Freud, Marie Bonaparte, Anna Freud, Melanie Klein, Jacques Lacan, to name a few. There are about 30. Okay. We also know that Bourgeois first saw her psychoanalyst, Dr. Henry Lowenfeld, after the death of her father in 1951. This loss resulted in a deep depression that lasted over a decade, during which time Bourgeois was unable to produce any work, artwork. The first 10 years of the artist's psychoanalytic treatment enabled her to come out of her depression and to make art once more. So she had her first show in 64, after the 51 crisis. At the same time, the therapy confirmed Bourgeois' sense of herself as a psychoanalytic subject, specifically a Kleinian subject. As psychoanalyst and feminist Juliet Mitchell argues in her analysis of Bourgeois' psychoanalytic writings, so the writings that were on show at the Freud Museum, the artist was able to use her symptoms, and she uses the word use in a particularly Winnicottian sense of using, in a psychoanalytic sense, to continue to make her work. Mitchell notices that the writings are filled with, and I'm quoting, an imbrication of various and multiple preoccupations, such as would arise within a clinical session. So she's taking on her role of being an analyst and looking at this work, this writing. By focusing on Bourgeois' articulation of violent jealousy in these writings, Mitchell concludes that if psychoanalysis is a process through which the patient is relieved of their symptoms as a means of being cured, then Bourgeois' treatment, and I'm quoting now, cured her of nothing, nor should it have done. She used it to become an important artist. The talismanic precept of psychoanalytic treatment is, where id unconscious is, their ego conscious shall come to be. For Bourgeois it was, where id unconscious is, there shall a sculpture unconsciousness come to be. The paradox that Mitchell is highlighting is the way in which Bourgeois worked with the knowledge that making manifest her repressed emotions, such as her jealousy and rage, which is what Mitchell was specifically looking at, within her psychoanalysis, meant getting better. But if that were to happen, her artwork would suffer as these repressed emotions fueled the creative process. Thus, Bourgeois' conflict was knowing that getting better and becoming a significant artist were in tension. Because of this tension, Mitchell is attuned to the frequent references in Bourgeois' writing to acting out rather than working through. In acting out rather than working through, Bourgeois was able to, and I'm quoting Mitchell again, keep the emotions raw and alive because her sculpture was to make conscious what we all experience unconsciously. She thus has to have more, not fewer, of her symptoms. Both good and bad experiences must be intensified. She goes into what is unbearable, unknowable, which is why it is repressed, and makes it conscious in visual form. Art historian Mignon Nixon, who's been writing about Louise Bourgeois for a long time in relation to Klein, takes a different tact to Juliet Mitchell. Nixon traces the letter L in Bourgeois psychoanalytic writings, L for Louise and L for her analyst Lowenfeld. Tracing this letter and its meaning, Nixon uncovers the ways in which Bourgeois' politically and ethically charged artwork and her psychoanalysis function in relation to the complex machinations of the Kleinian subject. Feelings of aggression and violence are followed by anxiety, guilt, and fear, and then the need for reparation, and then it starts again. This is the case because, as Nixon explains, Bourgeois holds herself to account daily, right? 1,000 sheets, and that's the ones we found, even hourly, in a painstaking catalogue of self-examination, duly acknowledging the pleasures of her own beastliness and the pain of its boomerang effects. Unsparing but never self-lacerating, Bourgeois recounts the psychic facts of life, the destructive impulses in one's life. Nixon concludes by proposing that Bourgeois' relationship to her psychoanalysis is a form of negative transference. For Klein, negative transference is at the center of analysis. Feelings of violence, aggression, anxiety, and guilt are key. Spending long periods of time in this exhibition and with this writing and work meant spending time with, on the one hand, forthright, aggressive, demanding, claustrophobic, and exhausting objects and texts, and on the other hand, being consumed, surprised, delighted, and stimulated by the thought-provoking truth that was being presented, and of course, empathizing. The dichotomy the show affected opened up the consideration that there may be a correlation between the use to which Bourgeois put her psychoanalytic treatment, a use that enabled an acting out through her work, and the way in which the work and show acted out and used the sight and the viewer. How so? Bourgeois was aware of the dilemma she faced as a modern artist, a need for psychological release and an audience to witness that release. She wrote, and this was also in the show, "The drawing is the most basic psychologique release the modern artist is caught in a dilemma in that he considers art as a psychological release and at the same time wants to have an audience. As a viewer, we are members of that audience of whom Bourgeois speaks. And so was the museum. In entering the Return of the Repressed inside the Freud Museum, we move into a condensed version of Bourgeois' already complex world. Layer upon layer of material objects, artworks, words, and memories come together to create an almost claustrophobic space. This is a result of the artwork and writing itself, as well as the enclosed and restrictive space of the museum. A space that, when filled to the brim with intense work such as Bourgeois', leaves the viewer little room to escape psychologically, emotionally, and literally for a breath of fresh air. The site, with its intense psychoanalytic history and memories bearing down on the viewer, as well as the intimacy of the space as a domestic and analytic one, results in a compressed relationship to Bourgeois' writing and artwork, and this work gives us no relief. There are so many verbal, visual, and tactile objects, images, and texts in the exhibition, and so much intensity. Artworks are fragmented, broken, missing parts in bits and pieces. The artist's writing is strong, aggressive, overwhelming. Slowly moving through the intervention, looking, reading, listening, seeing, engaging, remembering, sympathizing, retracting, shaking one's head in astonishment and disbelief, and then in recognition and empathy, a viewer finds herself repositioning her emotions from sympathy and acknowledgement to hostility and anger, back and forth, over and over again. The experience is dramatically conflictual. We are subsumed into Bourgeois' world, the dramatic world of a Kleinian subject. The intensity of encountering this show inside the Freud Museum results in a love-hate encounter with Bourgeois' art and writing practices. Following Nixon in the writing, we are witnessing a form of negative transference. Following Mitchell, the experience is not one of working through, but acting out. Is it then the case that the love-hate relationship that we experience when encountering the show in the Freud Museum is one that rehearses the acting out of a negative transference? As a complicated form of autobiographical fiction, it is as though the artwork, documents, and exhibition are acting out the complex situation that Bourgeois negotiated all of her life. And as a viewer, I was giving it back, loving it and hating it, both at the same time. I have one last paragraph, but I don't know. Should I? Okay. In conclusion, you can also end just loving it, hating it, because that's the kind of the point. But in conclusion, I wonder if Adam Phillips is not right. Phillips has written the provocative statement that those who want to continue misleading themselves about the past write autobiographies. Those who want to know themselves and their history have psychoanalysis. That'd be great for all of the analysts in the room, right? His point is that when undertaking psychoanalysis, the repetition of the actions and stories we practice and tell ourselves are broken down, then rebuilt, told differently. That is how we stop misleading ourselves about the past and come to know something of ourselves and our history. Clearly, the access I've been granted by Bourgeois and Bonaparte is to a representation of each of the women that constructed through a form of autobiographical fiction. The photograph in Bourgeois' writing attests to something that is personal, Bonaparte's relationship to Freud, Bourgeois' understanding of herself as a Kleinian subject. At the same time, there are representations that attest to the fictional nature of representation. Each time we write or speak the word I, we encounter something of ourselves and also construct ourselves. Certainly, both art and psychoanalysis have a transformative potential and alter one another. But ultimately, because art is not a psychoanalysis and a psychoanalysis is not an art, although maybe the speakers this afternoon will have something different to say, the two psychoanalysts this afternoon, what we are presented with are autobiographical fictions. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
My talk is in two parts. So firstly, I'll talk a bit about my practice, and then I'm going to talk specifically about my current exhibition, Unravel These Knots, which is at the Freud Museum. If anyone suggested my work was like therapy, I would recoil at the idea. The issue with this is an assumption that the process of art therapy positions the quality of the final artwork as secondary to the therapeutic benefit of making as an activity. I think my work has more purpose as a conveyor of messages than a procedure to maintain my own well-being. Nevertheless, I decided not to entirely resist the link to see what the relationship there might be. Embracing what I think art resists can provide risks that actually help my practice. One of the functions of my work is to lay open my unconscious, as I might through talking in sessions of psychoanalysis. I want my work to offer up material that forms a kind of narration of my experience of life, not in a linear sequence, but in the way it comes to mind, in fragments and associative thoughts. Susie Orbach, speaking about beginning the process of psychoanalysis in a talk on authenticity in 2011, said, "Once we have words, we can symbolize our experience." For me as an artist, pictorial scenes, abstract motifs, text, and object making all hold equal status and serve as symbols of experience. When Orbach says, "Once we have words," she's referring to speech. And despite my use of different forms, I think there are close analogies in my work to talking. When I make drawings, which is the basis of my practice, I deliberately don't plan what I'm going to draw before I start. I just look at the blank paper and draw what comes to mind. I depict past experiences, memories from different times, and things that are vital to me today in no particular order. I think this is close to the way we talk to each other. We tell fragmented stories of our lives, continually moving between the time zones of the present, past, and projections of the future. Once I've made a number of drawings, I'm able to group them together by association to particular subjects. These groupings can form installations, and later the drawings might be regrouped differently, or a small group of, say, up to three drawings might begin a painting. I also don't ever plan a whole painting before I start. I have to make it happen as I go along. Again, this is like the natural flow of talking or thinking, as opposed to reciting from a script, like I am now. It allows unexperienced creative thoughts to be employed and gives painting a vitality, reliant on innovation and leaps of faith. Something spoken in real time can't be taken back or erased. In much of my work, I set up a situation where marks that are made are indelible, and things tend to be made at once without the possibility of or need for correction. As you'll see, I paint straight onto surfaces like silk and paper, knowing that whatever I lay down is what stays on the surface and is simply my way of conveying that thought at that point. This immediacy could seem intimidating because one might worry that a mark could be wrong, but conversely, for me, it lends an enormous freedom to the work and lifts off anxiety. It releases me from the cul-de-sac of right and wrong and convinces me to work freely. When I'm speaking freely, I'm not worrying about how I'm saying something. I'm able to say it without second-guessing myself, and language seems very rewarding. If I'm self-conscious, I get all tongue-tied. So one of the key conditions of my work is to be unself-conscious, not to inhibit any ideas I have, and not to avoid any subjects as long as I really believe that I'm telling of something that matters to me. In an online interview, when asked about the job of a therapist, Susie Orbach explained, "Nobody comes unless they're suffering, and they may or may not have words for it. So my job is to try and help them find a way to transform the shape of their suffering and how it's living inside them or outside them, so they can be with themselves in a different kind of way and get interested in themselves and see who they are as being absolutely unique but a less fixed proposition, less determinist about their own self, their own relation to self. So I would hope that they come to see a more complex view of who they are. And also, people come hoping for relief from their symptoms, but paradoxically, what gives them relief is a recognition of the legitimacy of their feelings rather than getting away from them." When I started working like this, I was actually in crisis. My husband had died, and I was then a single mother to two young children. My expectations of our future as a family had been crushed. I couldn't make any work that interested me, so I didn't believe in myself as an artist, and I felt everything stable in my life had broken apart. I wanted to allow myself to be really pathetic, to let go of expectations of success, which seemed to cause so much pain, because in comparison to my expectations, I thought I was failing. When I really let go and made some very feeble drawings on paper, I discovered a curious delight in the liberation of doing whatever I wanted without measuring it against rigid standards of success. I let go of my old practice entirely, and almost exactly as Orbach describes, being less determinist, less fixed, gave space for a much more complex and richer practice. This is Ellen Siksu. "When you've lost everything, no more roads, no direction, no fixed signs, no ground, no thoughts able to resist other thoughts. When you're lost, that's when, where you are unwoven weft, flesh that lets strangeness come through, defenseless being without resistance. It's in these breathless times that songs of an unheard of purity flow through you. Addressed to no one, they well up. These are the cries that death and life hurl." I was making very slight things that didn't hope to be amazing artworks, and I found real enjoyment in it. Gradually, I began to accept making work as an ongoing life conversation, which brought it down to a very real level. I was making work addressed to no one but myself. But also, I stopped being afraid of failure. Once I realised I could deal with things that really mattered to me in my work, I think I'd recognise the legitimacy of my own feelings. Likewise, the way things were drawn, was not dependent on rigid perceptions of skill, coolness, knowingness. In fact, not knowing, letting strangeness come through, seems so much more exciting than knowing. When I mention speaking, it's worth thinking about the voice. I want to speak in my own voice. As Ellen Sixou articulates brilliantly in her essay, Coming to Writing, women belong to a history made up of millions of singular stories, but traversed by the same questions, the same fears, the same uncertainties. The woman's voice is more often linked to autobiography than authority. Sixou's essay outlines the struggle in finding the right to write. I'm interested in establishing the right to speak in painting and making art. Drawing like this, using pictorial watercolour lightness, using light fabrics like silk and sewing, pinning and using decoration forms a language through which I'm unashamedly working with my own gender. I'd like to say here, on my own terms, because I don't want to specifically state that those things are attached to my gender, but they are for me. As well as revealing the story of my own life and psychology, I hope that the non-specificity of the character of the figures without faces can refer to other lives, can translate to experiences in common with the audience. I'm reliant on gesture and body language to give the meaning of an image. The figures have to be doing things that reveal their psychological state rather than, say, frowning or smiling. Aristotle, in Poetics, explains that all human happiness or misery takes the form of an action. The end for which we live is a certain kind of activity, not a quality. Character gives us qualities, but it's our actions, what we do, that we are happy. It's in our actions, what we do, that we're happy, or the reverse. Character alone, say, as a portrait study, seems inert to me. Figures doing, living, interest me so much more and convey more meaning. My work is not about me in isolation, it's about me in relation to things. My work's really asking, what's it like to be alive from my perspective now? And ask other less prosaic questions like, where do we go when we're dreaming? Significantly, we can't record, say, digitally or photographically, the images that manifest in our minds that represent memories or dreams. Anyway, if we really try to see those images, they're elusive. They tend to slide away from us. I'm trying to show what those images are and how imaginative they are. For this reason, a figure in my work can be looking one way and another way at the same time. They can have many limbs because they're doing different things at once. Space can be transparent, people can be transparent, and so on. I'm often thinking about non-Western art, like Indian and Persian miniatures, Japanese prints, or medieval paintings, for depictions that are pre-photographic, before the conceit that the camera takes images that are realistic. What realism looks like is something that I'd like you to consider. Realism and truth, like documentary, are often interlinked, but I think it's possible to be truthful without using the type of language that symbolises what we in the West call realism. Now, I'd like to read you a poem by Anna Freud, written for her nephew Heinz in 1918 when he was born. It's called Encouragement. Yes, by strange hands and unasked, you'll be set down in strange rooms, where you can turn your steps forward, backward, anyway, and as you like. Don't be foolish and ask the path when you see others going aimlessly. Try yourself. All those standers by, not one can tell you what's right. And you should find things your way, testing them with your own hands. What's on the surface, what you see, gives false notice of realities. Maybe you'll have to wander many paths in the cold and dark, but who promised you that only for joy were you brought to this earth? So now I'm going to talk about the work in the show. And this is a drawing called Unravel These Knots. Anna Freud's poem starts with runes and describes life as a process of finding ourselves in situations that aren't chosen, whether as a child or an adult. The spaces we inhabit are accommodated into our sense of ourselves, into our memory, our life story. When I step into Freud's study, I'm always transported back to my own grandparents' home, some of the strange rooms where I was set down. The resemblance between the two spaces is very striking. It's in the physical layout of the conjoined rooms, the exact similarity of the materials, but also in the collection of artifacts. Standing there, it's as if a condensation has taken place, like in a dream, where elements of my own grandfather's study and the family sitting room have been strangely compacted. This is just an aside, and I was going to take it out because I think it might be boring. So if you want to, just have like a sleep moment. My grandparents arrived in England in 1933, 5 years before the Freuds. My grandfather, Kurt Mendelssohn, was one of a group of young German Jewish scientists who studied under Einstein at Berlin University. They were specializing in low temperature physics. Lindemann at Oxford University recognized the importance of their research and brought them to the Clarendon lab to continue their work. He was forward-thinking in rescuing them from Nazi Germany. My grandfather caught liquefied helium for the first time in Britain, and the work of Franz Simon, who was Kurt's cousin, was crucial in the development of the atomic bomb. So you can see how this research was sort of quite vital. Kurt stayed on at Oxford, and his subsequent travel as a visiting professor of physics took him all over the world, where he collected antiquities, which he displayed throughout the house. Incidentally, the funds to pay for these young scientists to come to Britain were diverted from the Oxford University Department of Archaeology that year, a debt that my grandfather recognised in the foreword of his book, The Riddle of the Pyramids, which is his theory about how and why the pyramids were built. And it seems appropriate to mention this in relation to Freud's analogy of psychoanalysis being like archaeology. So I'm only too aware that little detour and my description of the Oxford house suggests a bourgeois background, but it doesn't really capture the reality of my childhood. For me, the house in Oxford was representative of something of an escape and a container for my imaginative leaps. I lived there briefly, age 4, after my parents divorced. My mother remarried and I grew up on a housing estate in the Medway Towns. In contrast to the suburban 1970s house I lived in, the Heimat of my grandparents provided a familiar otherness, a thinking space with the richness of its visual elements and objects, which filtered into my consciousness and probably propped up my own thinking, my own creative thinking. In this drawing, Unravel These Knots, placed in Freud's study, fragments of carpet patterns painted on Japanese paper are collaged together to make one carpet, which hangs from a stand a bit like a blackboard. It acts as a screen in the space. It stands upright, present, not so much a simulation of the carpet, but more as a pictorial presence, like the interference of the memory of my grandparents' home occupies my mind when I'm in the room. The detail of the pattern painted by hand, with little marks in places, looks threadbare, worn away. I was thinking about life as a series of knots that make up a bigger pattern, like a carpet. All these woven-in patterns we adopt. The actions in life are tiny marks in a bigger mass. In the drawing, there are fragments of text that say, "Tears fell from great heights, big dollops, you don't know, you weren't there." Like a conversation left in a room. Once, a friend of mine asked my grandmother what she remembered of the war, and this was her answer: "You don't know, you weren't there." It was a very definite blank pasted over the subject. I was very taken with Freud's writing on screen memories. The idea of the screen memory is that the memory of something anodyne, say like a piece of furniture, something material, a colour, a memory from childhood, can screen a more traumatic memory. As Freud put it, screen memory is one which owes its value as a memory not to its own content, but to the relation existing between that content and some other that has been suppressed. This is a lithograph called Sex Fantasy. Aware of all the conversations that have been had in this room, Freud's study, all the narratives which have been explored, and thinking about the material that I might bring to psychoanalysis, should I lie on Freud's couch, my lithograph, Sex Fantasy, rests like a newspaper that's been read, but it's now laid to one side, some remnant of involvement, as if the presence of a person is evident. I decided to make a series of folded drawings that could be opened up like albums, like Japanese prints, shunga, of my own sex fantasies. I was interested in looking at a number of drawings together to see what common frameworks and motifs they might have, what the stories of my fantasies contained psychologically. It was, and is for all my work, important to be really honest about the imagery, not to invent or fabricate the fantasy scenarios, but to try and get as close as possible to what's really in my mind. I'm really interested in the drawn language of Japanese prints. I think about them a lot when I draw. My dad has lived in Tokyo for 40 years now, so they are images I'm very familiar with. And yet, they're still far away. In that world they describe in such detail, in that the world they describe in such detail is unfamiliar. I'm particularly interested in the way the same line is used to describe something simple, like people doing domestic chores, as is used to describe very explicit, erotic and fantastical imaginative imagery. The level of detail and the analytical arm's-length relationship to the subject really fascinates me. It's curious how something so explicit can also be so beautiful. I was trying to hold this kind of balance in my own print without copying Japanese prints to try and get the element I find exciting about them. I also think the relationship between the screen drawing and the print imply for me the way psychological subject matter exists in the same place but have their specific boundaries or locations. This is called Interpret My Dreams. It's a curtain made of six silk panels. It's a huge digital print on silk, which was then hand-painted with watercolour. The silk curtain was identified as a way to make something flowing in the space, something light that transformed the space while occupying an integral part of the space. I wanted to make something that had the presence of a dream event in the museum. The drawings are all from archetypal dream scenarios, remembered from my own dreams of searching, climbing, falling, flying. And you'll see in the imagery that one figure, there's like a red outline and a green outline, and one figure can be doing two things. One of them is trying to climb through a fence as well as climbing up a fence at the same time. So I was trying to articulate that kind of multiple notion of dream imagery, or the experience of dream imagery. And I also use quotes from Freud's text, The Interpretation of Dreams, which acts as a kind of dream-like narrative voice when you're sort of looking at the whole of the piece. And there are bits of text of my own writing that are inserted in there. So it's, in a way, this idea of the way things get drawn together, things that are not from the same place get drawn together in dreams. And I also was thinking about this idea that a curtain in the day is opened, but the imagery of the curtain is closed up, so we can't see those images. And a curtain is closed at night when we dream, and the imagery of the curtain is opened out, so that type of relationship. Some details. This is called Interpret My Dreams Case Study. It's in the cabinet, which is in the exhibition room in the museum. And if you've seen, maybe you saw in Joe's talk, or you might be familiar with it, the cabinet is lined usually with a kind of beige or light covering. It's a very sort of plain space, which has glass shelves, and is used to show objects, artifacts, material. And when I was thinking about this exhibition, I thought, what might happen? I mean, unlike Joe, I became really interested in dreams while I was making this exhibition. And I think it's like someone described to me, if you're hang gliding, you have to look where you want to go. Because if you look at something else, you end up going over there. And I think this kind of interest in dreams is a bit like a hang gliding accident. It's like, I didn't mean to go there, but I just ended up becoming really interested in dreams. So I wanted to think about how this space of the cabinet operates usually, and then to think about what painted space is and the transformation of, say, a canvas to a painting, and the transformation of space in a dream from one state to another, which is very imaginative. I think the things we manage to come up with in dreams is quite amazing, and how quickly we can do it. I was thinking about things you might do naturally, like writing, scribbling, mark-making, the loose, untamed gesture, and alongside that, the organised pattern. So I recorded the images and narratives from my actual dreams to lay out what's going on in my mind and to see for myself what I'm thinking about. So in each one, there are four sections, and in each section are a number of images and text from my own dreams. So they're kind of floating in this space. And as I said before, each panel that I paint and each part that I'm writing with paint, it has to be as it is, as I do it. Which, you know, there's something about that, like it just is my translation of the dream. So they've got all kinds of different narratives going on in them. And then there are some shelves with these objects, which I think of as intangible things. All the object-based work I make is called intangible things. They're not called sculptures. They're not called objects. They're things. And that's important to me because I don't really want to name them. And I like the fact that they take up space in the physical world, and yet they're about something you can't quite put your finger on. So in Freud's writing on the interpretation of dreams, he mentions in a footnote, there's always one part of the dream which he describes as unplumbable, like a navel. And for some reason, this just really stuck in my head, this one element in a dream that you just can't know what it is. And unplumbable, like a navel, this idea of the navel that you can't enter into, that's closed up after birth. It's such a peculiar image. And I wanted in this piece to have my unplumbable, intangible things as a physical, the sort of physical things that are propositions there within the dream space. Okay, this is the last piece of work I'm going to talk about. This is called Dreamer, and again, it's an intangible thing. Have I gone really over time? Okay. This is Anna Freud's couch, and I was really struck by the humble cover of the couch and the quality of the very humble cushions. I mean, maybe in comparison to Freud's couch, which is like, you know, super extra. And hers is, you know, understated, but it's so interesting. There's something very touching about it. But also I know that Anna Freud was really interested in knitting and weaving. And I know she was interested in knitting to the extent that her parents had to ask her to please, can you stop knitting? So there's something about the fabrication of the cover and the way the cushions are fabricated that's somehow very touching to me. So I wanted to place a head, one of my intangible things, on Anna Freud's couch as if this head is in a session and is thinking and recalling, and maybe recalling fragments of dreams. And the head is made with very, very reflective, shiny fabric on the front. And it has this hair which, a lot of the time when I'm making heads in my work, I'm trying to make them have grey hair because I have grey hair. And also because in representations of women, I think it's about time women with grey hair were represented as the glamorous, wonderful things they are, but also just that they could be represented. So it has grey hair, but it's knotted. There's a real confusion about, in my mind, about the way Freud talks about plaiting and weaving, because he relates them to a kind of penis envy. And I think that, anyway, there's something here in asking a whole load of questions which might be asked in the space of Anna Freud's couch that are quite different than the sorts of questions that I might have proposed with my sex fantasy print on Freud's couch. So there's sort of two things going on there. But there's also this curious... I mean, I made those two cushions that come along with my intangible thing and this extra blanket. I made them myself. And there's also this kind of knot of intangible forms. And my sense of that knot is that at the end of a dark, almost tunnel, there's a piece of something which might be picked up from looking around the museum like a fragment of carpet as a memory. And it might just sit there at the end of a kind of bit of thinking. So that if you were in a situation, or if this intangible being was in a situation where they were recounting and talking about their dreams, they might, or their thoughts, they might come back in fragments, these parts of what's been dragged out of the physical world. And it also is all knotted together. And so that once you start talking about one of them, you find that it's joined to a whole load of other things. That's about everything I've got to say. Good.
Hi.
I'm Emma. I'm Emma.
So we have about 15 minutes for discussion. Am I right in thinking
yeah.
that?
Yeah, we've okay. got time for Joe and I to do a short Q&A before we have a break. So, yeah, maybe we should...
Do you want to sit up here?
Thank you. Thank you. So, I wonder if any of you actually do have any questions for us.
Or we can have a super long coffee break.
Yeah.
And no, I'm not going to tell you what I think of Emma's show in the Freud Museum. I thought that would be the first question. She's never asked me to write about her work.
Yet. Is that, yeah.
I just wanted to ask about the site specificity of the work. Did you actually make pieces specific for them?
Yes, I did. And it's a really good question because it reminds me of something I should have said anyway. That one of the things I was really aware of when I was looking around the museum thinking about making an exhibition there was this was someone's home. And rather than make an exhibition where my work would, say, be added to the walls of that home, I wanted to make work that was incorporated somehow in the space, thinking about you know, the materials of the home, like what's in a space, what sorts of things. So I think that's where the idea of the curtain came about. I mean, I remember when Carol was showing me around the museum and I asked about the curtains in the dining room. Are they the original curtains? And Carol said, no, they're not original curtains, they're the curtains that are here. And that must have just landed in my mind somehow and been festering away, because then I thought, well, actually, if they're not the original curtains, then it's almost as if there's a space that something could happen that's exciting, because it... I mean, what's exciting about it, which is sort of technical in a way, is that that scale of digital print on silk, the company that I was working with, Coriander and Kerwin Press, had never made that scale of thing. You know, it's a thing that technically is quite exciting to be able to do. And for me to then be able to paint by hand on top, because it's digital print with watercolour, and to use watercolour on that scale. That, for example, you know, that's a wonderful opportunity that comes from working in a space like this, or thinking about how the work can sit in a space like this. And then sites... specificity would have to be really at the front of one's mind if you're going to do an exhibition in a space like this, because as Joe described, there are so many things there. It's such a particular place. There's so much to engage with that if you didn't think of that, I don't think it'd be possible to not think of that.
I think it's important to say that Emma's approach to the show at the Freud Museum and in making new work for the show is quite unusual in the history of the exhibitions that have been at the Freud Museum. So that the space has been considered, definitely considered, but it isn't site-specific in the usual way that we think about site specificity. It is usually... artists are putting work that have been previously shown elsewhere, usually a white cube kind of setting, into the Freud Museum. So there is editing, and there are decisions that are being made related to the Freud Museum itself, but very few have actually made work for the Freud Museum. And I think that's kind of interesting. So one of the challenges in my writing is, what does that mean? What is that? What can we call that? So I've used this word site responsive as a way of thinking about actually what happens to work when that is normally shown in a white cube and it's put into the Freud Museum. What is the relationship between that work and this context, and what becomes activated by having that work in the Freud Museum in terms of the work itself, the artwork itself, and our understanding of that artwork, because it shifts. Which is, of course, the beauty of showing work in the Freud Museum, but also for the museum itself, you know, what histories, repressed histories, changed histories, alternative readings of psychoanalysis or the practice or the history of it or the domestic setting is enlivened or invoked by having work in the Freud Museum. So, if... Denny.
I'm
just aware that I did notice that.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Related to what you said about dream, the showcase, the grey showcase, the sort of bland showcase as a metaphor for the practice room where you bring your dreams. And although you're very resisting to speak of your dreams, or Joe would say, mm-hmm. No dreams, I hate dreams, I don't want to. Mm-hmm. You bring, and then the dreams take you somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. That's maybe that's part of this kind of resistance to think, I'm not talking for you, Joe, but kind of resistance there could be in terms of dealing with dreams, say in artwork, is that in some respects it could be a bit of a cliche, this idea of this sort of inventive space of dreams and then making paintings, say, or imagery from this inventive space of dreams. You know, it could be such a cliche. And yeah, that's, you know, almost why I'm describing it like that. It's kind of the thing that you feel like, I mean, actually while I was making the exhibition, I came to the Freud Museum and there was a big dream catcher hanging up in the window, you know, which is on the first sort of floor of the space. And it really made me think, oh my God, the dream thing could be really problematic. Because, you know, dreams already have their kind of own vocabulary in terms of how we talk about them or share them. So, in a way, yes, it's about dreams, but it's also about something to do with what painting could be. You know, it's about making artwork, and it's something to do with sort of how painting might operate as well as being about dreams.
I just wanted to highlight that it's very interesting that we're talking about this resistance to exploring dreams. And I'm really struck that Dali never had any issue with it. He was a man, and you know, for us women, that seems to be really, really problematic to fall back into and be seen to be in a position of interiority. You know, we're dealing with the personal and therefore something that doesn't really have any resonance in relation to culture, society and political issues, which I think psychoanalysis make those links. And the deeply personal and the unconscious talks of much wider issues. So I suppose I want to talk about art, what you referred to earlier on, art resistance to the unconscious or psychoanalysis, and whether that has, I think you mentioned that you felt your own resistance towards it, and I was wondering whether through this exhibition and this investigation, you have sort of there has been any shift, but also I'm curious to know your peer group, artist peer group. What were their views?
Well, first of all, what I was saying was about a resistance to art being therapy, rather than a resistance to therapy per se, or psychoanalysis, or, you know, but I'm not really talking about a resistance to those sorts of ideas or, you know, the exploration of those fields. I'm talking about if you make work like I do. I'm going to talk from my own experience. Sometimes people say, oh, your work must be, you know, it's nice, it's like therapy. And I think, well, why does that make me recoil? You know, I'm just interested to know, rather than just recoiling, which I can also do, I like to sort of ask myself, and maybe what I was saying is that that's kind of a bit of a key in my work, is like, what is the thing that I think I need to avoid? Rather than avoiding it, why do I think I need to avoid it? Because the way I might do something with it. You know? And the quote that I'd use from Susie Orbach sort of described that thing where, you know, there's something you resist, but actually in the process, maybe what you find is that you don't... It's not that you have to get rid of it, it's that you have to kind of be able to deal with it. You know, so I was interested in that idea, but I was also, what I was saying about therapy is that why would I recoil from that? And why I would recoil from that, I think, is that the process of therapy in terms of art therapy is that the process of making offers a kind of idea of well-being. I mean, tell me that I'm wrong. This is my thought about it. The process of making an art therapy is meant to generate this sense of well-being or a sense of kind of exploration or, you know, understanding or whatever it is that is more important than the look of the final artwork. You know, it's the process that produces the effect, that, you know, does the work. Whereas as an artist, I feel like making the thing that stands there when I'm not there, or is there when I'm not there, that has a is a conveyor of messages, is what I'd like my work to do. So that's how I termed my resistance. That's how I understood my resistance. You know, I'm not saying it's the same for everybody. That's how I'd understood it.
I just think personally, it's a real strength to recognize one's inconscious impulses within the work, because we all have them. But there's a real resistance to actually, in artist practice, to refer back
those are like a whole bunch of sort of quite different things. I mean, I think that's quite a lot of stuff, you know, in your sentence there. I think that's like quite a number of issues all tangled together and sort of knotted together. Honestly, if I was going to unpick that, it might take me a lot longer. I mean, like, hours. Really. I mean, not to...
5 minutes.
Yeah, we've got... Sorry.
One more question.
Okay, one...
Last question.
Oh, no, this lady after.
You ask first.
Yeah, her and then her.
It's not really a question, it's in response to...
Oh, okay. A response and then...
Which was just if... I think as an artist, if you were to analyse your work in that way, it would become reductive. It would then reduce it to one meaning.
Mm.
Whereas if you leave the work and then you can allow others to project their own interpretations or relate to the work.
Whereas if it has a set meaning, it reduces it in some way.
Yeah. And the last, the lady that you were...
Hi, it's right. It's a while ago, it came to mind now, but no, I was just interested in what you were saying about, well, the kind of, I don't know if there's a kind of crossover between what you're doing and art therapy. I'm an art therapist, so, but I was just sort of thinking about when the artwork might stand on its own for somebody who's been in art therapy, for example, which might come at the end of the work. But I think it just feels like there's an interesting overlap. I mean, what you're describing feels very different, but I think there's a lot that can kind of take place, certainly for me in my work. I'm very influenced by psychoanalytic thinking, so there's quite an overlap there, and I think it's quite a complex process.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I nearly didn't include that first paragraph because I thought it was a bit of a kind of ant's nest, but... Then I thought, what the hell?
I think what you're saying about what we resist or what we avoid, and just wondering about that is very interesting.
Yeah, well, I think any way as artists, well, my experience of being an artist is that there are resistances any way in the art world that we're all aware of. And it's whether we're going to make ourselves subject to them or whether we're going to do what we want to do is quite a sort of interesting question.
Okay. We're going to have tea now, so for the couple of people that want to ask questions, you're welcome to ask them at the end when all speakers will be up here and we'll have a Q&A. So thank you very much for listening and for participating.